it's a real joy and a real privilege and a real challenge to preach through the gospel texts. And, you know, I was thinking about the sermon this week, and we're in this series on the Gospel of Mark. And for throughout Christian history, by far the most sermons have been preached out of the Gospels than anywhere else. And it's been a little different maybe the last 500 years, but for the most part, the Gospels have been the primary text for Sunday morning worship for Christians since we began. And so a lot of ours, in turn, most of our texts are also from the Gospels. Very important to preach the Old Testament, teach the Old Testament, the epistles. All Scripture is God-breathed, right, and useful for instruction and training and rebuking and all the fun things that we need in our lives. But we're settling in this gospel rhythm, and so we really believe that when we're preaching through a text like this, one of the benefits is the text determines the nature of the sermon, not the other way around. So I don't just wake up and decide all the things we want to talk about and then go find scriptures that support what I already want to say. And that's hopefully good news for you and for me as well, that we're all challenged as we move through these gospels together. So we continue in Mark this morning in the text that Zolly read for us. You know, we're about to start school, and some of us sooner than others. And then before that, we've got practices starting and good teachers all around. Good coaches, good teachers, some of them we have in this church. And you all know that good teachers know when to put the pressure on. They know when to come to the rescue of their students. And they know when to let them struggle a little bit, right? It's just like parenting. There's a balance of letting your kids struggle and figure stuff out, and then sometimes having to bail them out so they don't wreck something or hurt themselves or the whole deal. So it's a fine line. I tend to be, by nature, more of a helicopter parent. I'm so thankful that Amberly is sensible and most of the time says, honey, they have to figure it out for themselves. You can't babysit them all the time. And so it's good for me to always hear that, but it's always a balance. When I was about 14, I started riding colts around the ranch, and it was scary at first. The animals were larger, and I was unsure how I was supposed to do this, so I was learning kind of as I went. And I had patient teachers, one in particular, and you know, he would get in the round pen with the colt, and he would kind of say, okay, this is what the horse thinks when you move over here, and this is what the horse thinks when you move over here. And when you move towards his shoulder and he's turned this way, this is what he's going to do. Now watch this. And then he would let me struggle and he'd let me fall over and he'd let the horse look at me funny and say, now what are you doing in here? And he'd work through all that with me until finally I figured out a little bit more on my own. Okay, this is how this works. Because he could tell me and he could show me, but then you just have to go out there and do it. So he would watch me struggle. He would let me struggle. And then he would bail me out if it looked like it was going to be a wreck. One fond memory I have in particular, they didn't all turn out this way, but one of probably the horse that was my favorite horse throughout my whole life was a horse that I later called Biscuit. And Biscuit was a sorrel horse with a blaze face, and he was, put it kindly, let's see, he was irritable as a colt. So as a 2-year-old, he was a pill, and I hated him, and I thought he was never going to make anything. And I spent so much time with him. It was a project that probably should have taken me 2 months to kind of get him ready and lined out and ready to use. And it probably took me closer to 2 years just to get him where anything usable was in the question. And like I say, he later became good, probably just lucky. But I spent a lot of time with him, a lot more time than I should. It was a struggle to work with Biscuit all the time. But he taught me a lot. I learned a lot. We kind of learned together. In the text that Zolly read for us, the disciples are struggling. If you picked up on it, they are struggling. So even in a very tough set of circumstances, accomplished fishermen should be able to cross this part of the Sea of Galilee in about 6-8 hours at the most. And we know that they've been dismissed. Jesus dismissed the crowds and he sends the disciples on, and they're just going and going and going, and they're struggling. Mark tells us, with the oars. They are having a hard time. And it's already the fourth watch of the night, and they still haven't made it across. It's not a big, crashy storm. It's wind. You know, it's wind, like West Texas wind. It makes things challenging, but not impossible. They're out there doing their work, and they're having a hard time. So one of the early questions we ask, we read a text like this is, gosh, what does this have anything, any bearing on my life when I struggle? When's the last time you struggled at work? The last time we struggled as parents? The last time we struggled as caregivers or as members of a board? The text begins with Mark's trademark time marker, which is immediately. Okay, things are moving along. We've fed the 5,000. We've learned something about this. Everyone's been satisfied. Everyone's been got what they needed, and there's leftovers. And immediately, Jesus makes his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side. So he's sometimes in the boat with them. This time, he sends them by themselves. Y'all get in the boat, cross the lake. I'll see you later. And Jesus dismisses the crowd. We don't know why he sent the disciples away before he dismissed the crowd. Some scholars believe that the disciples were with them there and their heightened anticipation that maybe the crowds get the wrong idea, that this is the guy that's going to overthrow Rome and we're going to have this big yeehaw party. And Jesus wanted to keep things mellow, keep things focused on the fact that he was the Messiah, that he would save a different way. So he sends the disciples first. Whatever reason, he dismisses them, then dismisses the crowds. And what does Jesus do? He goes up on a mountain to pray. Remember, before he fed the 5,000, he was looking to get away with the disciples to have some time alone with God. And he didn't get it because he was interrupted. So now he tries again and he goes to a mountain to pray. Jesus is often at the times that he prays in Mark's gospel, he's preparing for something big. There's a big thing that the disciples need to learn or somebody else needs to learn, and he's getting ready. He's praying to his Father. In verse 47, when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and Jesus is alone on the land. So the disciples are on their way. Jesus is doing what he wanted to do. He's there praying, and everything looks okay. This is how he set it up. In verse 48, Jesus sees that they are making headway painfully. Isn't that a great way to translate it? He saw that they were making headway painfully. The NIV translates, he saw that the disciples were straining at the oars, for the wind was against them. All of us know what it's like to strain against the oars or to make headway painfully. You think about your workplace, and maybe your workplace is literally affected by the wind, and it slows you down when you have wind involved. Others of you, there's wind shows up as other things, making work difficult. Jesus sees that they were straining at the oars, for the wind is against them. We learn something about the nature of God in these texts where Jesus notices the crowds, and in this case, notices the disciples. Right? He sees the crowds in the previous story, and he has compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. He sees that they're hungry, so he feeds them. He sees that the disciples are struggling, so what does he do? What does God do? What does a God that created the heavens and the earth, what does he do when he sees his people struggling? About the fourth watch of the night, between roughly 3 and 6 a.m., Jesus came to them walking on the sea. There he is again. He feeds those that are hungry, and those who are struggling and afraid, he comes to them. He comes to us. He approaches us walking on the water. And we're just as shocked as the disciples were when he approaches us and meets us in our struggle. I mean, it's a crazy sight. They all thought it was a ghost. They were all terrified. I think we're much the same way when we noticed Christ moving close to us. Jesus came to them. The Lord finds us in our struggle. He finds us in our struggle without fail. If I haven't learned anything else about God, I've learned that he finds us in our struggle. God is concerned with hunger previously, and he's concerned with fear in this story. He comes to them walking on the sea, and then we have this little editorial note. He meant to pass them by, which is just kind of hilarious. He comes to them to be with them, but he meant to pass them by. Now, what is this? Is this the good teacher just giving them a little extra time to struggle? He's going to watch them just a little bit longer. I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but I believe, at least in part, this is a reference to Moses. This is a reference to Elijah. What did God tell Moses when Moses says, God, you have to show me that you're going to go with us, right? Because if we're not known by anything else as a people, we're known as the people that you are with. And so you got to give me something to let me know you're going to be with us. When we go out from this place, I need to know that you're with us. And God says, Moses, I will pass by you. I will hide you in the cleft of the rock. And I will pass by you. You won't see my face, but you'll see my back. I'm going to pass by. What did he tell Elijah? When he said, pass by. And there was a loud, those earthquakes and all the stuff. And then finally, the still small voice. God passing by has a connotation of nearness, has a connotation of presence. So this ghost, they think they see a ghost. And they all saw him. They're terrified. Who is this person that's walking on the water? Who is this Jesus that's been leading them these days and these weeks? We get a big clue into who Jesus is, first of all, because he's walking on water. In the Old Testament, the only one that walks on water is God, right? In the Psalms and in Job, there's nobody else is mentioned in the Old Testament walking on water except for God. And in the beginning, God's hovering, right? The Spirit is hovering over the waters. So we learn there's something divine about Jesus. He, a little bit more, he is God. And if that wasn't clear enough or obvious enough, immediately again, Jesus speaks to them and says, okay, so he's walked out to them. He's seen them in their struggle. He's walked to where they are. And immediately he speaks to them and he says in Greek, ego eimi, I am. Just what God told Moses when Moses asked for his name. Well, what should I tell people your name is? Just tell them that I am sent you, right? I am the great I am, the divine name for God. Jesus says, that's me. I am God. I'm here with you and I'm speaking to you now. So he tells them, take heart or let your heart take courage. It is me. Don't be afraid. Not only does Jesus move towards them, not only does Jesus walk on water, not only does he speak to them with affirmative words that only God could say, but then Jesus gets in the boat with them. And I find that just pretty impressive and pretty comforting. Because what do you need when you're struggling? Do you need a bunch of advice? Do you need someone to come in and tell you what you're doing wrong? Do you need someone to come in and just say, here, get out of the way and give me that? Or do you need somebody to just get in the boat with you? You know, that's what we really need when we struggle, right? Is someone just to be there, just to pat us on the shoulder and say, I'll ride this out with you. I'll help you get through this. Jesus gets into the boat with them, and then the wind ceases. I don't know what my response would have been. I'm sure it would have been similar to the disciples, utterly astounded, shocked, amazed. They've seen these kinds of things before, but they're just overwhelmed. I mean, they're tired. They've been struggling all night. Row, row, row your boat. And here Jesus is in the boat with them. The wind dies down. Things are calm again. And the disciples are anything but calm. They're still panicking. They're utterly amazed. And the paragraph ends with Mark telling us that they were utterly astounded. And then he gives a reason. For they did not understand about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. I have no idea. You know, first reading of this, I was like, that just looks like a speed bump. Like you're reading along, the story's flowing, everything's good. Okay, they're utterly amazed. That's the end of the story. But no. They didn't understand about the loaves and their hearts were hardened. It just seems like a major curveball. Why is that in there? Why did Mark put this last little bit in there about the disciples' response to Jesus walking to them and comforting them in their fear? There's no explanation. So it invites some reflection on our part. It seems out of place, but it's a reminder that the Gospels are not primarily like Aesop's fables. They don't have these nice, tidy little, and now this is the moral of the story for every paragraph that you read or every story. Half the time, we are confused. It's like, not only does Jesus speak in parables, but he acts in parables, and it's like riddles, and we don't know what's going on. What exactly is happening? This type of literature, in the Scriptures, for us in particular, invite us to explore. Invite us to wonder, where is our place in the story? Can you find yourself in this story? Can you locate yourself in this story? Can we find ourselves where we fit in the mix here? Can you find yourself in your own workplace or in school or in your home, in the places that you struggle? Can you see yourself there? Maybe it's also an invitation to explore more deeply in our own souls, at the heart level, you know, where the disciples are, hardness of heart is keeping them from understanding things. It begs the question, where in our lives is hardness of heart towards God keeping us from understanding things about God? Perhaps the disciples aren't quite ready to move from a miracle, loaves and fish, Jesus walking on water, to understanding, something a little more, we would maybe say, pedestrian or simple. Maybe they're not ready to make that move. They're okay living with, you know, supernatural event to supernatural event, but when the rubber meets the road and just basic faith and understanding, maybe they're a little behind. Hard for them to understand. Jesus is God, and God is with us. In Mark's gospel, faith is often a decision that has to be made in the midst of struggle. Now, faith always has the element of God's gift, or else we can't have faith at all, because faith is, by nature, it's a gift. It's a virtue. But it has a decision-making element that for Mark always seems to be right in the midst of struggle. We don't get to learn how to practice our Christian faith in la-la land. We learn how to practice our Christian faith in the real world, where we have struggles all around us. Struggles every day. This is a reminder that our Christian discipleship is more threatened by our hardness of heart, by our lack of understanding, than by any external threat we could ever imagine. Our Christianity is much less threatened by anything that could reach us from without than it is the things that we struggle with inside. Hardness of heart, lack of understanding. So, in closing, what is my heart's response to the presence of Jesus today? What is your heart's response to the presence of Jesus today? What is your mind's response? What is my mind's response to the presence of Jesus today? Sometimes it seems like the heart is the floodgate, you know, and it opens and everything comes together, and the mind and the understanding, and it all clicks. Other times the mind is the floodgate, and we have an aha moment, and then the heart and everything kicks in and we're ready to go. I don't know where you are today, which boat you're sitting in, but as Jesus sits with you in the boat, as he sits with me in the boat, my prayer for us is that we would not have the same response as the disciples. I mean, it gives us some comfort and peace, knowing that they were still responding to Jesus this way. All right, we should not be down on ourselves. What is our heart's response? What is our mind's response to the presence of God today? Jesus himself is the prize for an open heart. He's the prize of our understanding. And as we prepare to take communion together, I'm also reminded of the story when the disciples are walking with Jesus right on the road to Emmaus. And remember what happens? They're slow to understand, but they recognize him in the breaking of the bread. And then the heart kicks in, the mind kicks in, and they go, oh, right! Weren't our hearts burning within us when he was explaining the scriptures to us as we were walking? Right? It all comes together. Sometimes it's a cascade effect. What is our heart's response to the presence of Jesus today? What is our mind's response to God with us in our struggle today? Amen.